They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:04, Wednesday, August 17th. This is the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, still clearly recovering from the Saratoga flu. We missed you guys.
Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. You're about to see in a minute, John Green is growing his beard back. John, I got to tell you, I'm not in favor of this. You look 10 years younger without it, pal. I know that's tough to hear, but I'm saying it. I'm here for you as a friend.
I appreciate it. Anytime I can take fashion advice from Bill Finley, I really have to listen. That's true. Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable. And listeners, I don't know if you realize, but this is show 150 of the Writer's Room, which is about 149 more than most of us thought we would get to.
That's right. Well, I don't know if you remember, but John wasn't on the show initially. He came on and then he just wouldn't leave the office. He stayed in the office until we put him on the show as a regular. I guess it worked out.
That's right. That's exactly right. Well, you know, there are worse things for sure. Like my beard.
Yeah, no, I know. I wanted to contradict that because I'm in favor of the beard, John. So
thank you.
Who's more stylish, me or Bill?
There's no question. There's no question. I'm going to take, you know, hipster advice from you, Joe, and you know, basically everything else from Bill.
All right, yeah, cool.
Joe, you're a 30-something guy. You don't have to worry about how you look. The old folks like me and John, I mean, it is a pertinent point. Do you look older with a beard or not? To me, that's many reasons why I never grow a beard. That would be one of them, though.
All right, we'll leave it at that.
That's all we have for the 150th show. Thanks again, guys, for listening.
We had one bit about John's beard, and now we're out. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland, home of the world's yearling sale. The Keeneland September yearling sale begins Monday, September 12th. You can learn more at theworldsyearlingsale.com. Okay, so we had a good weekend of racing at Saratoga. The best part of it is that I was there. It was great to catch up with people, see a lot of close friends they hadn't seen in a long time, have some dinners, have some drinks, and it was a blast. Perfect weather. Just before we get into the racing, go to the Paddock Bar. Like, if you're up at Saratoga this year, I know some people had mixed feelings about it at first. There's no better place to go hang out and watch the horses than the Paddock Bar. It's tremendous. It's like the best casual post-up spot you can have at Saratoga, and they did a great job with it this year. Everybody, even the people who didn't like it, once they got there, they saw it and they loved it. So on the racetrack, the big race of the weekend at Toga was the four-star Dave. Will Chad Brown ever win the four-star Dave? Someone start a collection plate for Chad Brown because he just can't get it done. He had Regal Glory, who was the filly, who was favored in that race, ran second to Casa Creed, who's just such a nice horse, just shows up every single time, no matter what the pace is pretty slow in that race. Now has won the Jiper at 6 furlongs and the four-star Dave at a mile in back-to-back races. He was terrific. Also, Damon's Mound looked really good. He looked awesome on the track. And I thought there should have been a smaller odds discrepancy between him and Gulfport. And he really left no doubt that he was the better horse than Gulfport. And it's really cool. It's always nice when there's a trainer like Michelle Lovell, who has never started a horse at Saratoga, come in and win a grade two stakes race because she has a really nice two-year-old. That's the kind of story you love to see. And that's the kind of story that, you know, Saratoga revolves around. You know, everybody likes to talk about Todd Pletcher and Chad Brown, but really it's also about the smaller trainers who get this one shot, one or two shots in a lifetime at Saratoga, and hopefully they can come through, and Michelle Lovell did. I think Katie's got a story with her coming out either later today or later this week. There's a little bit of action at Churchill as well with the first Churchill Arlington Million card. We talked to Tyler Gaffleone about his win on Santine in the Arlington Million. Got a nice figure, got a 106 buyer, only going a mile and an eighth instead of a mile and a quarter. But what did you guys think about any of the weekend stuff?
Well, Joe, you hit on all the topics, the highlights of Saratoga. Casa Creed, a very nice horse. And yeah, I mean, it's just bizarre how there's this one race that Chad Brown can't win. He sent out two of the five horses in the field. I believe it was a five-horse field. Casa Creed is a very good horse. I didn't like him in a mile. I thought that that was a little bit beyond his limits, his best range. But he got a great trip. He got a great ride. And now the question for the connections, do you go for the Breeders' Cup Turf at a mile, or do you go for the Breeders' Cup Sprint, which is only 5.5 furlongs at Keeneland? So he's, you know, he's kind of in between both. The perfect distance for him would be 6.5 or 7 furlongs, I think. They're obviously not going to get that. Also, Damon's Mount is, what a cool horse he is, and what a cool story this is. And it's not just Michelle Lovell. I mean, nobody's ever heard of these owners. It's a homebred. And I want to talk maybe a little bit later about the Arlington Million, but I want to ask John a question. I'm going to throw it to it. They said after he broke his maiden at Churchill, they turned down $1 million for this horse. Now, what is he worth? John, what do you think when the – and I'm sure the bloodstock agents were still calling, and I don't know if the connections just said lose my number or not, but what do you think would be the fair market value? What could they get for this horse at this point?
Well, the fair market value and what I would pay are two different things, and not because I'm cheap, but because you look at this and you say, all right, what has the horse done? And the horse has won, broke his maiden very impressively at Churchill Downs, no less. So it wasn't even like he won it at a bush track. He won very impressively. And then he took on Gulfport, who was the prohibitive favorite in the Saratoga Special. But even that race was 6.5 furlongs. So I think it's still a little early to tell whether or not, the horse is going to be the favorite in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. And you guys, would know better than I would as far as the number of horses that have won the Saratoga Special and gone on and won the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. I don't think there's that much of a correlation. That being said, you look at the yearling sale that just happened up at Saratoga, and horses were selling for $600, $800, $1 million, where there were 14 horses that sold for over $1 million. And they're not only haven't run before, but they're like a year and a half away from starting themselves. So, $1 million for a really nice looking Girvan, ran an 84 buyer first time out and an 86 buyer next time out. I think that people are still going to be talking about, obviously, seven figures for the horse and maybe up to $2 million. But if it was me, if I was giving the advice, I would still say, let's wait and see if the horse can go 8 furlongs or maybe even 2 turns before we start throwing some of the big dollars around. But no disrespect to the horse. He is a really nice colt.
And let me get back to the Arlington Million, because then we're going to throw it back to John after that. I thought that Churchill Downs deserved credit for running these races after Arlington Park closed down, and they do. But in hindsight, these races it didn't have any juice whatsoever, no electricity whatsoever. There's a couple reasons for that. First of all, the people only one European outfit came. That was for the Beverly D. Adrian O'Brien should be a horse. No foreign starters in the in the Arlington Million. Short fields, not a lot of star power, et cetera. And then we have an interview coming up later with Tyler Gaffalione, who won the race on Sandine. And I'm sure he's got some interesting perspectives on it. But that turf course looked like it was dirt and somebody took a can of spray paint.
Yeah.
And painted it green. It didn't even look like a turf course. Now, that's something that can be corrected. It has to be over time. I mean, Churchill can't, go forward over this. But now in hindsight, with all the talk we've had over the years about the show, about we have too many stakes races and, we got to get rid of some, I've done a 180 on it. Maybe it's just time to put the Arlington Million out to pasture.
I think you have to give Churchill credit for at least trying to keep the race going between the Beverly D and obviously the Arlington Million, because grade ones are still, difficult to come by. So I understand why they were trying to, continue the tradition and have the race there. During the interview with Tyler, Joe asked him flat out, what was the turf course like? And it was a very interesting, answer that Tyler gave. Be that as it may, Santin looked good. He did it the right way. It's the second time that he's won a grade one and his second time winning a grade one on the Churchill turf course with Tyler aboard. So that one wasn't too much of a surprise. As far as other races, in my estimation, that really impressed me, I have to say Big Invasion winning the turf sprint, on Saturday, I believe it was.
On Sunday.
All Big Invasion has done is, he's run seven times. He's got 6 wins in a second and, really just was toying with the group that was in there. And he went off 1-2 for a reason and he showed it. I mean, he blew by those horses like those horses were tied to the inside rail. Christophe Clement has done a phenomenal job campaigning this horse and picking the races. And I believe, guys, I heard the rumor that the horse, Big Invasion, is not going to run again until the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint. And if that's the case, I would, I understand. And again, we did that with Helium after winning the Tampa Bay Derby, and you say, you know what, we got the horse exactly where we want him to, and we're just going to kind of coast into the, you know, into the big race. And I can understand why the powers that be, Reef Thoroughbred owners and Christophe Clement, want to do that with Big Invasion. But I in the beginning of the summer, if you would have said to me, you can have Golden Pal or you can have the rest of the field for the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint, I think it would have been, 50-50 in my mind. Golden Pal ran and won, but I was much more, personally, I was much more impressed with the way Big Invasion did it. And he's a three-year-old that's ascending. And I think some of these older horses, whether it's Golden Pal or Arrest Me Red or A Case of You, all of which ran in the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint last year, I don't think that they're as good as Big Invasion is aspiring toward right now.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought him up because to me, he was the most impressive winner of the weekend. And you can kind of get lost a little bit when you have that kind of win streak. And you just keep winning these smaller stakes because there's no grade one or grade two races for three-year-olds sprinting on the turf. So he kind of gets lost a little bit because he doesn't have that marquee win in terms of a top-level success. But he looks so good and continues to look good. And Joel Rosario just fits him so perfectly just to make that one run. And the good thing about him, too, is like he's an off-the-pace type, but he doesn't need a pace meltdown. Like if the pace is, you have to stay somewhat close going 5.5, and he could do that. You know, I remember the two-back race, the half was like 43-4, and he was like 2.5 legs off of it. So he clearly has enough speed to hang around and still have that big kick. And yeah, he could not have looked any better on Sunday. I tried to beat him a little bit with John's horse, but at the end of the day, Big Invasion was just a class above those horses. And it was interesting reading the quotes from Christophe after the race, where he was like, maybe we'll try something like the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint. He was being like very cautious about it. Like, what else are you going to do with this horse, man? Like, it's too late to send him over to Europe now. It's just there's not really any more big turf sprints that I think you could do and then still be back in time and ready for the Breeders' Cup. But yeah, he looked absolutely tremendous. And one other horse I wanted to mention was a maiden winner on Saturday. It was the Todd Pletcher 3-year-old first time starter by Liam's Map Express Man, and he looked very, very good. That race was over in the blink of an eye once they turned from. Got a 107 buyer. Always on the lookout for horses first time out who can run those kind of figs because they're few and far between. So I think he's definitely a horse to watch. Pletcher had another nice filly on Sunday, Chocolate Gelato, who won by a bunch. So Pletcher, Todd Pletcher, as usual, has got that stable of big two-year-olds, especially on the dirt, and even a nice, really nice three-year-old first-time starter as well. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. The catalog for the 2022 Keeneland September sale is now live and features 4,147 yearlings. The auction covers 12 sessions from September 12th to September 24th. Book one includes yearlings out of 89 graded stakes winners, 36 grade one winners, plus siblings to 50 grade one winners. And also tickets for the Keeneland Fall Meet are now on sale. 17-day meet includes 22 stakes worth a record $8.9 million. 9 Breeders' Cup winning year-end stakes will be held during Keeneland's opening 3-day Fall Stars weekend. Get your tickets at tickets.keeneland.com. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
When the thoroughbred world descends upon Lexington this November, there is one place you need to be. The place where history comes alive with every championship victory.
He's authentic indeed!
The place where the future is built with the fall of a gavel. The place that exists to be the heart of this industry. The center of it all. Home to the November Breeding Stock Sale and 2022 Breeders' Cup, Keeneland.
He was just put together like a machine, and he had a great mind. Everything about him was what you'd want.
Tis the Law pops the cork in the champagne.
Tis the Law is going to win the first leg of the Triple Crown.
I've never seen him get tired.
Respect the Law. Tis the Law.
His structure is just perfect. His bone is perfect.
He's left the others behind. He's going to win the Run Happy Travers.
He's everything you would look for in a horse.
The TDN Writers Room was brought to you by Coolmore Justify. He got his third stakes winner with Just a Warrior, who took the Ellis Park Debutant Stakes on Sunday. Justify also had a winner earlier in the weekend with I'm Just Kidding. He's a half-sister to grade one stakes winner Bar of Gold, who John's familiar with as the dam of coinage. Am I correct in that? Yep. And then also, she broke her meet on Saratoga on Friday. Also, fellow Ashford sire Practical Joke had an impressive winner on Sunday, who I just mentioned. Chocolate Gelato broke her maiden by 8.5 lengths. Practical Joke is now the sire of 6 juvenile winners from his second crop. Now let's check out our interview with Tyler Gaffalione, who won the first Churchill Arlington Million. Obviously one of the top young riders in the country. A nice guy as well. Had a good chat with him, with me, John, and Tyler. Check it out. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. You can learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we're thrilled to welcome to the show the first winner of the Churchill Arlington Million Stakes, Tyler Gaffalione. Thanks for coming on, man.
No, thanks for having me, guys. I'm excited.
Great to have you on. I wanted to do like the Pete Aiello, Tyler Gaffalione thing, but I'm like a little under the weather, so I didn't want to screw it up. But I love that when he does that, when you come in the winner's circle. So let's start with this. Was it different? How different was it riding at Churchill than it would have been riding at Arlington Park, both because of the course and because of the distance? It was only 1.125 miles this year, as opposed to the usual 1.25 miles.
It was definitely a little different. I've only been to Arlington once. It was, I believe, like 2015. Huge fan of the track. I was bummed I never really got to go back. But I think Churchill did a great job hosting it. The track was safe. We had no issues. And I think it was a good day for everyone.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on that real quick, John, because there was a lot of talk about the Churchill turf course and how they had to suspend turf racing for a little while. What did it feel like to you compared to a normal turf course?
It was a little more firm. It's been real hot there the past few days, so it dried up pretty quick from the rain they had the previous week. Just a little more firm than normal, but I didn't see any issues with it.
Gotcha.
And Tyler, you had won before. You'd won a grade one before on Sandton, which also, ironically enough, was at Churchill. Going into the race, you were the third choice in the race. Did you feel confident going in there, having won on won a grade one on him before on that turf course?
Most definitely. I've worked him a few times over that turf course earlier in the spring. He's always shown a liking to it. He was working great up here at Saratoga. So we had a lot of confidence going into the race.
I wanted to ask you about this because I think you can really tell between like the top 15, 20 riders or so in the country compared to some of the lower level tracks, just in their style of riding. Like you can watch them on horseback and think, well, that's a guy who should be at the upper level tracks. Are there any people in particular that you modeled your style after or that kind of shaped the way you ride horses?
I would say probably Garrett Gomez and Jerry Bailey are my two biggest influences. I grew up a huge Bailey fan and try to copy him as much as possible.
Like what specifically would you try to incorporate if you were studying them?
The way they ride a race, I loved Bailey's strategy going in. He knew where to be at all times, always seemed to be in a perfect position. Gary Gomez was very versatile, very aggressive down the lane, and I love the way he finished on a horse.
And Tyler, you've been, aside from being one of the top riders, you've been really consistent. I don't think people realize that you have an 18% win percentage over the course of your career, and just about every year you either average like 18, 19, or 20% wins and about 50% of the money. What's the secret behind that? Because that's a very consistent win percentage and win place and show percentage.
I've been so fortunate throughout my career, but I would have to say having a good agent and getting on the right horses is key.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember you first coming up at Gulfstream too. Was there a horse or was there a particular meet that you had where you felt like you had turned the corner and then you had arrived? Did you have that moment?
I believe riding through the championship meet down at Gulfstream, when I was an apprentice, I think that helped a lot. I was able to ride with guys like Johnny V, Javier Castellano. I learned a lot from them. It was probably my worst meet I ever had, but definitely gained a lot of experience from it.
Gotcha. And Tyler, just to stick with the numbers again, you're at 1,900 wins and change. You're basically projected to accomplish the 2,000 win milestone, sometime before the end of the year, maybe sometime around the Breeders' Cup. Do you think about the 2,000th win? Do you think about who what race you want that to be in a perfect world?
I've thought about it a couple of times, but I would just be so blessed to even get there. Hopefully everything goes well and we can continue to pick up some nice horses and continue to win some races, and we'll get there when we get there.
And what will it mean to you when you get the 2,000th win?
It would be so amazing. I remember when I won my first race, my 100th race, it's been a lot of fun, and hopefully we can just continue this.
You know, Bill Finley wrote a story recently asking whether or not this Saratoga jockey's room is the best jockey colony in the history of American racing. Obviously, you're a younger guy, so you don't remember the jockey colonies of the 80s and early 90s that he was comparing them to. But like, but just give us a sense of what it's like to be in that jock's room and to know you're going against the best of the best every single day. Like, what are the difficulties? What are the things that benefit you? Like, what's it like?
I love it personally. It's very challenging. Every day you got to come in and give it your all. These guys, they're not going to take it lightly. Everybody's out there competing, trying to win races. And like you said, the best riders in the country are here and they're putting on a good show. So just to be mentioned among them, it's truly an honor.
And Tyler, your part of having you on was to celebrate your grade one win. Also, a small part of having you on was a little self-serving because you won some big races for us recently and as far back as a couple of years ago. Give the audience an idea of what you think about Wonder Wheel, who's our two-year-old filly that hopefully is going to be running the Breeders' Cup. And you also rode a turf horse for us that just came over from Europe, Catamosto. And even though he didn't win, we were really excited about the way that you rode him and the experience that he had. What is it like to ride horses like that?
It's amazing. Makes you feel special, you know, for the top trainers and owners to come to you and ask you to ride their horses. It's such a privilege, but I love the filly Wonder Wheel. The day she broke her maiden, they said that she wasn't the quickest two-year-old. She definitely seemed like one that was going to be down the road, but she took me every step of the way that day. As soon as I put her out in the clear, she jumped into it, and then she came back, ran a great race, and I believe it was the debutante. Yes, and she showed a lot of speed that day. It kind of surprised me, but she was doing it so easy the whole way. Her ears were going back and forth. Very talented filly. She worked great last week, so I'm excited for her. And Catamosto, it was a little difficult before the race. I heard that he had a little bit of trouble in the gate, but Joseph O'Brien did a great job schooling him. The gate crew knew exactly what to do. He jumped out well, put himself in a great spot. I think first time going around a turn, threw him off coming into the stretch. Seemed like he got a little bit lost, but as soon as the horses came to his outside, he re-engaged, finished up good. We ran second behind a really nice horse, so I don't think it's anything to hold our head down about.
Yeah. Is it different riding for a guy like Cassie versus riding for a European trainer like O'Brien? Do they have different training styles in the morning?
I would have to think so. I haven't been too familiar with Joseph yet. I haven't met him in person. He was here about a week and a half ago, I believe, and I didn't get a chance to go by there, but I spoke with him on the phone the other day. I have all the respect in the world for him. He's done it as a jockey, continuing his success as a trainer. And I was just so thrilled to get the opportunity to ride for him.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you this because this is the horse that I associate with you with most so far. I don't know, maybe you agree, maybe you disagree. It's War of Will, because I remember that Preakness win. And I remember to see a little bit of a spark on your face when I bring him up. So maybe you agree. What was it like to ride him? And just can you describe the feeling of crossing the wire first and the Preakness for your first classic win?
War of Will was amazing for me. He taught me so much. I remember to this day, I think it was a Risen Star. We walked in the paddock and he was getting tacked up. And Mark was a little bit nervous that day. There was high expectations for him and we were trying to get to the Derby. So, of course, pressure's there. But I just remember looking at War Will and he just had the most calming presence about him. Just a look in his eye and just gave me all the confidence. And he went out that day, showed up big time. And then we get to the Preakness and we had a little bit of trouble in the Derby. And there's some controversy there. So there's a little bit of a struggle leading up to it, but he didn't blink at all. He was there for me every step of the way. Didn't hesitate when he went up the inside. And I remember maybe 100 yards before the wire, I just kept thinking, no way, this can't be true.
Yeah. Yeah, for real. And I remember there was like a quote that you had where you were saying similar to what you're saying now, that all the talk in the 2 weeks after that Derby was about Maximum Security and the DQ. Did you feel like he got a fair chance in the Derby, or did you think that incident on the far turn just cooked him for that race?
We lost all chance when that happened. Going into the turn, I just got outside of Maximum Security. We got out to the two path, and he grabbed the bit, and I felt like I was about to win. Unfortunately, everything happened, and it wasn't our day that day, but he came back and showed up big time.
Definitely worked out for you guys in the end. Tyler, thanks so much for coming on, man. Love watching you ride and continued success, bro.
No, thank you so much. Appreciate you guys having me.
Absolutely. Good stuff.
Thanks, Tyler.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Tyler Gaffleone will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
Union Rags, proving Lane's End's tried and true stallion-making formula. A formula that leads to success for our partners and our stallions. He's a leader in his sire crop by graded stakes winners and grade one winners. He's a commercial standout with multiple million-dollar sales and a six-figure yearling average. And with four full books bred at 50 and 60,000, he has even more exciting progeny in the pipeline. Union Rags, a stallion that stands above the rest.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Lane's End. This week's Lane's End Stallion of the Week is Union Rags. The classic winning millionaire has sired five individual grade one winners, including this year's Santa Anita Handicap winner Express Train. This year, he's also been represented by grade two Suburban winner Dynamic One. He stands at Lane's End for $30,000. So we do have to have a Trainers Behaving Badly segment, I guess. We don't want to keep this one too long because, you know, this guy's kind of a nobody unless you're like on the Mid-Atlantic and like you bet Mountaineer or Charlestown or some of those races or some of those tracks. Burton Sipp, which I think is a great name for a country act, like either solo or group. And it's such a waste that he's a allegedly cheating trainer instead. So he was suspended last night by Churchill Downs indefinitely. And this is a guy that has a really, really bad reputation in the industry, and it sounds like with good reason. One nugget about Burton Sipp that I think should tell you who he is. He stopped training for a while in the mid-80s after a bunch of his horses died, and he was charged with insurance fraud. Now, he eventually pled to lesser charges, so you can't say that he definitely killed those horses, but it was at least brought up in the court of law. And then he went away for a little while. And then he came back and opened an exotic animal zoo in New Jersey, which is always something an upstanding and animal-friendly guy does. You know, Joe Exotic, if you ever watched Tiger King, those people are the worst people on the planet. And so this is, you know, just based off background, this isn't a guy that should be around horses or horse racing. And yet he's racked up a lot of wins. He's got over 2,800 wins, I believe. Like I said, mostly at Mountaineer. And that's, you know, he's one of those guys that's allowed to thrive, I think, in the shadows at some of those tracks that nobody pays attention to, really. And unfortunately, I think those are some of the tracks that people should be paying the most attention to because there's so little scrutiny and because, you know, I think there's a lot of lesser regulation than you would think and then you would hope, especially compared to other bigger states. But Bill probably remembers this guy a lot more than I do because he's been training for a really long time. Bill, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are that he's about the worst. Well, I'll tell you what, I won't give you my thoughts. In 1993, way back then, I did a huge story on this guy and all the problems he had. And this is what Hart Stoddard, a former commissioner of the Pennsylvania Racing Commission, had to say. Said he's the most deplorable person I have ever encountered on the backstretch of a racetrack. And you know what? Normally you won't get people to you know, throw in racing to say such stuff like that. I could have got 100 people to say that. So it would take all day long to go through his history and all the things he's done. The worst of which was the allegations that he killed the horses for insurance purposes. Now, you can't say he did because he wasn't convicted on that. He pled to a lesser charge, but still, where there's smoke, there's fire. But what has been happening lately with the guy, and lately, at least over the maybe the last 7-8 years, is that, you know, the people that watch the sales where that are for the killers, you know, his horses wind up in there one after another, after another, after another. Now, Mountaineer Park in Presque Isle, like virtually every racetrack in the country, has a no slaughter policy. If you're caught sending a horse to slaughter, your stalls are revoked, you're banned. This guy was doing this in plain sight. I mean, he wasn't making any attempt to go around anything. You know, and the question is, you know, why was this allowed to happen and nobody do anything about it? Now, I wish you were out by now because I would have loved to have been able to refer to it, but I've been talking a lot to Dan Ross of the TDN. He's working on a huge story that's hopefully going to come out, maybe even in Thursday's edition, where he asked the question that everybody should be asking. How is it that this guy, quote unquote, the most deplorable person I have ever encountered on a racetrack in my life, has been allowed to train for all these years? Now, he was out from, he was suspended and ruled out, reeled off. He had no starts from 94 to 2004. But from 2004 to present, he's found at least two racetracks, Mountaineer and Presque Isle, that said, hey, Burton, come on in. Enjoy the show. We need your horses. We want them in the entry box. What does it say about this sport that it was unable to keep a guy like this out of the game and to say to him once and for all, Burton, you're done. Go back and run your zoo in New Jersey and good luck with the rest of your life. That to me is the real story. And that's what Dan is going to write about. You know, again, and the things that we're talking about with this guy are just the tip of the iceberg. You know, when you talk about a guy with like the worst record you could ever find in horse racing, I'll put this guy up in my number one.
And you have to wonder from a logistics standpoint, from a licensing standpoint, and from a checks and balancing standpoint, why this guy is able to continue to not only get stalls, but get licensed. And guys, I know we've talked about this before, but it bears repeating. On the Kentucky State trainer's license, which I have right here in front of me, there are two questions that would, in my estimation, automatically disqualify him from getting licensed. Number one is, have you ever been fined over $250 by any racing jurisdiction? Well, it took me 2 seconds on Google through the Thoroughbred Regulatory Rulings website to see that in August of 2020, he was fined $300 by Presque Isle. So I stopped looking at that point because right then and there, he has to disclose that information. That's just one, okay, case. And the other one is, have you ever been ruled off, ejected, or excluded from a racing association? And the answer again is yes. He's been told that he's had his stalls revoked. He's been asked to leave racing jurisdictions. So again, he has to, if he's answering them honestly, and you say, John, don't be stupid. He's not going to answer these questions honestly because, you know, he's doing all these other things. So why would lying be any, you know, any worse than some of the other things that he's alleged and also been proven to do? So either he's committing, you know, fraud on these applications, or whoever the licensing officers are that looked, you know, at these applications are just rubber stamping them. And, you know, and just saying, oh, OK, he answered it and signed it and gave us his $200 to be licensed. So therefore, he must be OK. There's got to be a check and balance. Why even ask the question if you're not going to police it? It doesn't make any sense at all. And the other thing is, you know, West Virginia, especially, and I have relatives in West Virginia. Go ahead, insert joke here. But I have relatives in West Virginia. I've been there many, many times. There are really nice people, you know, in West Virginia. And it's a really great state to be in. But for the love of God, man, why are you fighting things like HISA that is going to protect you as a racing jurisdiction from get people like this? I mean, it's easy when you have a federal regulatory board coming in and wanting to protect you and protect your horses from just, you know, egregious, just you know, villainous people like this. Why are you fighting it? I don't understand. If you're going to harbor people like Burton Sipp and say, come on in, bring your horses here because we want you to race. Well, then that's your decision. But don't fight HISA. Just say, we're not going to be a part of HISA and let your industry kind of run on its own, just like Texas is trying to do right now. And at the end of 6 months, when you don't have a racing, racing anymore because you don't have any handle, then you guys accomplished exactly what you wanted to do. You guys did it your way. You went right down the tubes on your own terms. And that's fine too. But you can't be half pregnant in this situation. Either you're going to be a part of, you know, the way that modern racing is and basically police, have somebody else police you from having people like Burton Sipp come in and you know, and represent your racing in West Virginia or not. But either way is fine. Just don't try to gum up the works with, you know, by suing HISA on something like this. And I know this is going off the beaten path as far as we're talking about Burton Sipp, but I think it's just Burton Sipp is just one person that is just, you know, exemplifies why some of these racing jurisdictions either shouldn't be around anymore or should get in line and basically have somebody else clean up their mess because they can't do it themselves. But, it, you know, people like Sipp are just vile, 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 vile. They prove time and time again that they don't give a shit about the horses that they train. They don't care about the athletes whatsoever. All they want to do is line their pockets. And to me, that's just it plays right into the hand of exactly what, you know, PETA says and exactly what the general population thinks about our industry, that we don't care about the athletes, that we, you know, once they can't run fast enough, we can't get them out of our stalls fast enough. And Burton Sipp just exemplifies exactly that kind of, the kind of person that they see our industry representing.
Yeah, let me jump in, John, and I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, we tell our enemies, PETA and the other animal rights activists, that we love the horse, we care about the horse, we'll do anything we can for the horse. There are some bad apples out there, but we're going to get rid of them and we're going to root them out of the game. You know, what, and PETA hasn't jumped on this yet, maybe they will, but when someone like this charges, says of racing that, you know, it's bad and fill in the blanks for all the many reasons. You look at the Burton Sipp answer question. How do we answer our critics? What, if they were to come to you and say, look at Burton Sipp, how do we answer our critics? I'll tell you what, they're not right overall, but in the micro sense, in this case, they are absolutely right. Racing as a whole, as an industry, and you can point fingers at every racing commission that gave them a license, every racetrack that let them run. So it's not fair to point a finger at everybody. But as a whole, this industry failed the animal. And that's the thing that we are, had a social license been granted to us that at the end of the day, we're going to put the horse first and protect it every way we can. Well, in this instance, we failed miserably. And it's disgusting.
Well, yeah. The guy has 23,523 starts in his lifetime. I mean, that says it all right there. Like, this isn't a guy that popped up out of nowhere, did some shady stuff, and then we got him out of here. He's been doing this for decades, 23,000 starts. How many trainers even have that for a lifetime? Like, you know, relatively, I'm speaking, I'm sure, not that many. And John brings up an interesting point about Heisen, because I read a story from TD from last week in the TDN that he says now the industry is going to have to pay twice for all of these lawsuits, because Heisen is having to defend itself and spend a ton of money on lawyers for these lawsuits. And that those fees are going to trickle down to racing eventually. So, you know, we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot a little bit with those lawsuits. But yeah, I mean, there's just Bill. I mean, the point you guys make is right about the outside noise and how we combat that, because, you know, people ask me, and people who don't know a lot about racing will ask me, like, how do they treat the horses? And I gotta be real with them. And I will say that I think like 90 to 95% of horses in racing are treated really well, and that things are on the up and up, and you know, the horses are taken good care of, and there's a lot of positive momentum, especially for thoroughbred retirement and thoroughbred aftercare. So there is a lot of good stuff going on, but I can't lie to them and say, you know, we always do right by the horses, and every horse is taken care of. And these are the incidents that I'm talking about when I talk about the other part of it, the underbelly, the shady side of racing. And until we get rid of that, until we stamp all that out, you can't sit there with a straight face and tell PETA and tell the critics of racing that we do right by all of our horses, because there are too many people in too many racing jurisdictions that are allowing this stuff to happen and this stuff to fester. And, you know, eventually it trickles up. And you know, like Bill said, who knows if PETA is even going to pick up on this? It might be too small potatoes for them, but we know about it. And we can't defend our industry fully until this stuff is gotten rid of. And, you know, I think Heisen is trying to do that kind of thing. I think it's been a mess. It's been a really topsy-turvy, to bring that phrase back. It's been a topsy-turvy implementation that, you know, and everybody wished it would be a little bit smoother, but at least we're trying now. We're trying to get all this stuff under one roof and have uniform rules. And I think that there's no way that leads to more horses getting lost in the shuffle. I think it can only lead to fewer horses getting lost in the shuffle like this. And, you know, there are guys who are doing bad things to horses in this game that nobody, the general public, will never hear about. But it's on us. It's on us and our conscience, knowing that those people are out there. What are we doing to stop them? You know, and I don't want to spend too much time on this. We've already spent over like 13 minutes on it, because we do want to talk about the positive things in racing. This is our 150th show. We're going to get to it later and talk about how much this show means to us. And why it's done well in the industry, and that's positive stuff. But by the same token, like, these kind of stories can overshadow all of the good stuff that's going on in racing. And I think there is so much more momentum now to protect the horses first and foremost than there's ever been in my lifetime, at least, following racing. But it's not enough if guys like Bert and Sip are allowed to continue to race horses. And fortunately, it seems like now we're on the way to kicking his ass out the door. And he's not the last one, but for a guy with 23,000 starts and his resume, it's a big one.
And Joe, if I can just add one more thing, and I usually don't add things about the internet and Twitter and things like that, but I want to give kudos to Maggie Moss, because here's one of the most, influential owners in the industry. And she's unafraid to put out there on Twitter all the things that are going bad in situations like this. And every time every time I know about a horse going to a killer or a different situation that it shouldn't be in, it's because of the tweets from Maggie Moss that I understand and learn these things. So, I want to give a tip of the cap to her, because, she's an outspoken owner for sure. And she has won a lot of races and has done very, very well. But she's actually acting as, as a watchdog for some of these horses when they get put in unfortunate situations. And these horses don't have a voice. So if you don't follow Maggie Moss on Twitter, you really should, because she's the person who is bringing it to my attention, at least, and I'm sure to a lot of people's attention. And it's a good follow, because if nothing else, she's like our conscience right now. She's our Jiminy Cricket on some of these issues. And she's very good about bringing it up. And I think we need to have more and more people like that when they see situations that are unfair, unjust to the equine athlete. We have to bring it up.
Yeah, no, I agree. Maggie Moss, 1,000% is a great watchdog for the industry. She shouldn't have to be. There should be people who do this, who are paid to do this, who are paid to regulate and sweep bad people out of the game. But thank God she is there. And with the phrases, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And then Maggie Moss and a lot of other people on Twitter who started petitions about Bert and Sip, they deserve all the credit for this, because I don't think CDI would have done this if there weren't a groundswell against this guy. I think it would have just been business as usual. So, yes, big hat tip to Maggie Moss and the people on racing Twitter and the people out there in racing who are in Thoroughbred aftercare who have made us think about this. We saw it with the CHRB thing last week. That was a little less consequential, but there was such a big uproar about the CHRB media gag rule, basically, that CHRB quickly reversed course on that. So that's one of the things I like about racing is a lot of outspoken people who have their hearts in the right place. And we just need those people to be the vast majority of the people in racing and get more guys like Burton Sipp and Marcus Vitale out of here. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by the Kentucky Thoroughbred. Owners and breeders, Kentucky Breds continue to demonstrate why they're your best chance at Grade 1 success over the weekend with Arlington Million winner Santine and 4-Star Dave winner Castle Creed backing up Grade 1 wins. Find your next Kentucky Bred at the upcoming Keeneland September sale. We'll be right back after this message from the KTOB.
With some of the fullest fields in the country and quality racing year-round, there's never been a better time to reap the rewards of breeding and racing in Kentucky. Purse money in Kentucky is at an all-time high, as is average purse per race, outpacing California, Florida, and New York. Kentucky Breds. Breed them. Raise them. Race them. We all win.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. The XBTV workout of the week this week is Caravelle. Love Caravelle. Worked 4 furlongs in 47.81 training on the Saratoga turf on Sunday. Brad Cox trainee won the Grade 3 Intercontinental Stakes earlier this summer at Belmont. You can see that work on the screen right now. She's a beautiful gray daughter of Mizzenmast, who I love. One of my favorite, most underrated sires. I'm sure John agrees with me. One of the most underrated turf sires in the country. She's in the probables for the Smart and Fancy Stakes this weekend, which is a turf sprint for fillies and mares at Saratoga. So we'll probably see her as well. And yeah, Caravelle, very, very beautiful filly. Remember, she was the Liz Merriman horse, who she sold, owned by Bobby Flay, and now it's Cutter Racing. And she's certainly at the top of her class in that division. So this week's weekend preview is highlighted by the Alabama Stakes, which will be run on Saturday at Saratoga, one of the most historic Grade Ones, if not the most historic Grade One outside of the Kentucky Oaks for 3-year-old fillies. We're going to get the rematch of Nest and Secret Oath. It looks like Nest absolutely dusted her in the CCA Oaks, but Secret Oath is the Oaks winner. And I think that she'll have a better showing this time around. And hopefully we get one or two more horses. And it's not a four horse field, but I'm not going to hold my breath on that one. Speaking of short fields, we have the festival this week at York. We have the Judmont International coming up in about 40 minutes. Baid, who is maybe the best horse in the world, at least on turf, undefeated, just keeps going and going. Has a really tough task, I think, in the Judmont International coming up. And then tomorrow, we've got the Yorkshire Oaks at York as well. Alpinista is the horse that I would keep an eye on there. She looked incredible last time when she won at Royal Ascot. So she's a really nice horse. So we got some stuff going on over the pond. But like John was saying to me before off the air, it's not just America that has problems with short fields. A lot of these grade one, group one races overseas, we're seeing five, six, maybe seven horses. Now, obviously, they have a much bigger average field size than we do. But in the top level racing in Europe, I think there's a lot of similar problems to America in terms of the graded stakes fields. But back over here, the Alabama is the big race. We also have the Del Mar Oaks, which we'll talk about after the break. We have the Lake Placid at Saratoga and the Smart and Fancy, which I just mentioned in the XBTV bit. Any thoughts from you guys on the Alabama?
Yeah, it looks like there's going to be five in there, Joe, and we'll know later on today. Nest Secret of Gerrymander, Nostalgia, and Goddess of Fire. It's a race. You know, one of the good things about Saratoga so far is, you know, there's a lot of races that included, you know, showdowns or the best of the best going against one another. Well, I guess you could say you got that in the Alabama as well with Nest and Secret Oath. But is there any, you know, from the standpoint they just talked about, like really looking forward to what happens on the racetrack. To me, Nest thrashed Secret Oath in the coaching club. Why? And it doesn't look like any of these other horses are good enough to compete with her. You know, she's going to be 1-5, 2-5, and there's really no reason to expect that she would get beat. You know, back after she won the coaching club, the connections opened the door a crack about the Travers. And I really wish they would have done that. And that's from a standpoint of wanting there to be, you know, big storylines and big races. If you're going to be 1-5 in a grade one with, I believe it's $600,000 purse, you know, I can see that. That's just too much to give up to be 4-1 or something like that in the Travers. But Nest is a terrific filly. But I just don't see any reason why this race won't be a carbon copy of what happened in the coaching club. Joe, you mentioned a couple other races, but Sunday's the Queen's Plate, by the way.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Looking forward to that. And the favorite is going to be a filly named by the name of Mora, who comes off a big win in the Woodbine Oaks. And this is a fillies have won the Queen's Plate 37 times in its long history. And she's got to beat a horse by the name of Ron Dore, who won the prep for this up at Woodbine. But, it doesn't mean a whole lot to Americans. But to Canadians, this is their Kentucky Derby, and it's Kentucky Derby Day. So it'd be fun to watch the Queen's Plate on Sunday and Nest win, presumably, in the Alabama. Then I guess, unfortunately, won't that be your last race before the Breeders' Cup? Problem. I don't know that for a fact, but the way things are going and the way Todd Pletcher has campaigned his horses, he did the same thing with Malathot last year. So, you know, why would she come back and anything in between? I don't think it's going to happen. So we'll see what she does on Saturday.
And there's one more undercard race that I wanted to highlight, and that's the Skidmore, which is for two-year-olds going 5.5 on the turf. You say, John, why would you care about a listed stake? Well, number one, it's a Saratoga stake, so it does have some you know, interest to us on the East Coast. But also, it's been run six times, guys, and five of the last six winners have all been entries in a Breeders' Cup juvenile race. So it is a legitimate stepping stone. Even though it's only a listed stake, it is a legitimate stepping stone for the winners to come out and then run in either the Breeders' Cup turf sprint, the juvenile turf sprint, I should say, the juvenile turf, or try to transition over to the dirt and run in the overall juvenile. So it is an important race. You got horses like Averly Jane and Golden Pal and Flame Away. You know, they all utilize that race to go from there up into bigger and better things in the Breeders' Cup races.
Well, and thank you to Bill for bringing up the Queen's Plate. I did not mean to slight our Canadian listeners or any Woodbine fans. It's obviously a big race, and we're going to watch it on Sunday. I was scanning the stakes fields and was only looking at the graded stakes. Obviously, the Queen's Plate, $1 million, but is restricted to Ontario breds. Is it Canadian? Is it all Canadian?
It's Canadian. I mean, there's, I think, 98% of the good horses in Canada are. But yeah. If you got a good Saskatchewan bred, bring them on down. They'll let them run in the Queen's Plate.
Exactly. So yeah, we'll keep an eye on that as well. We're gonna get to the rest of the races that we're looking forward to this weekend after this break from Three Chimneys. Three Chimneys, outstanding young sire. Gunrunner has several maidens to watch out for this week, including Outperform, who runs on Friday at Saratoga for Todd Pletcher and Rapoli Stable. Gunrunner had his latest TDN Rising Star last week with Disarm, who broke his maiden for Steve Asmussen and Ron Winchell at Saratoga last Saturday. Gunrunner now has 5 TDN Rising Stars, and his list of Grade 1 winners already includes Champion Echo Zulu, Cyberknife, Early Voting, Taba, and recent Amsterdam Stakes winner. That's a Grade 2, but recent Amsterdam Stakes winner, Gunite, he was a Grade 1 winner last year. So I was looking at the TDN Sire list last week. The top 3-year-old, top sires of 3-year-olds this year. Gunrunner is so far ahead of everybody else, like including Into Mischief. It's just wild to see him in only his second year have those kind of stats for 3-year-olds. He's obviously had a tremendous, tremendous start to his career. And like I said last week, I think that the Stallion Farms are going to start snapping up those Grade 1 winners to stand the first really good sons of Gunrunner as well. And it just goes to show, you know, we talk about there's too many stallions overall in the country. When you get one like Gunrunner and they can kind of reshape the breed in this short amount of time, it really is a special thing. And that's what everybody is looking for. So we'll be right back after this message from Three Chimneys.
Here comes Taba. Taba in the center of the track with good looking stride, squares off with Cyberknife. Cyberknife takes the lead. Taba going with him. These two in a thriller. Cyberknife just in front. And Cyberknife has won the TVG.com Haskell over Taba. Jack Christopher finished third. The running time, 1 minute 46.24 seconds.
Gunrunner's on top of the world.
Come dream with us at Three Chimneys.
And it's all Tyler's Tribe to the final furlong. He's putting on another show tonight. He is 8 lengths in front. Now it's 10, now it's 12. Tyler's Tribe pouring it on as they come down to the line. He's going to win by double digits, and he stops the clock in 104.
All right, just to put a little bit of a bow on this week's weekend preview presented by Three Chimneys. We also have the Del Mar Oaks on Saturday, which is a Grade 1 for 3-year-old fillies on the turf. Goes a mile and an eighth. Interesting field. I think it's going to get a pretty big field in that race. That's one of the things I like about those 3-year-old filly turf filly races. I think in general you get pretty big fields in there. But the horse that I'll have an eye on, and I'm not 1,000% sure that she's starting because I'm just looking at the probables, but Spendarella, who I mentioned at Royal Ascot, ran a big second in the Coronation Stakes behind Alpinista, who's going to be in the Yorkshire Oaks, who I mentioned tomorrow. She's such a nice filly for Graham Motion. I want to see what she can do when she comes back to the States, because he had Sharing, who I was a big fan of, win the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies, then go over and run second in the Coronation, but she never quite got back to that top form when she came back to America. So I'm going to be interested to see what Spendarella does if we do indeed see her on Saturday. And then, like I said, we got the Lake Placid as well. Guys, do we need two 3-year-old filly turf stakes on the same day? Like, I get that they're across the country from each other, but like, can we have some kind of coordination here that we don't have these overlapping races in the exact same day on the calendar? But the Lake Placid usually does get a pretty good field at Saratoga, so we'll keep an eye on that. And also, we got the Islin at Monmouth, which, you know, that's one of those races that I feel like you could upgrade, honestly. Well, all the horses that have won it over the years and that have been in it, I'm not sure who's going to be in this year's field, but it's been stuck at a Grade 3 for a while. So even though, like, I think overall we should be downgrading stakes, Islin's one of those that I think produces some good horses. Maybe you can make the argument for a Grade 2. So Saratoga this Saturday, the Alabama Lake Placid, obviously the international action going on at York today and the rest of the week, and then Del Mar, well, the Del Mar Oaks, which is a Grade 1 on Saturday. Stuff to keep an eye on. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. West Point is now up to 999 wins, so close to that 1,000 after their filly Kadama won an allowance at Delaware Park over the weekend. West Point has several runners in for this weekend, including Brigadier General taking on Stakes Company in the St. Louis Derby on Saturday. So we're hoping we'll be able to celebrate their 1,000th win next week. Love all the friends at West Point. They were obviously very busy at the sales over the past week and a half as well. And, you know, they surely have a bunch more monster two-year-olds to unveil the rest of the year. I'm hoping it comes in Saratoga, that 1,000th win. Be a little anticlimactic if it came somewhere else. But, you know, wherever it comes, it's well-deserved for West Point. And so good luck to all the partners on getting that milestone, hopefully, in the next few days. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse, every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up and down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Legacy was on site this week at the Facing Tipton New York Bred Sale. They can sign a Bolt Doro colt that I think John has some comments on that brought $195,000, was the second highest selling Bolt Doro of the sale. They also have almost 100 yearlings cataloged for the upcoming Keeneland September sale. So we'll be taking a look at a few of those entries in the coming weeks. I know you guys are working super hard, so best of luck coming up at Keeneland September. And John, yeah, what did you think about the Bolt Doro?
You know, I had two people shortlisting for us at the New York Bred sale, and the Bolt Doro ended up on both of their lists. So I texted Tommy, you know, before the sale and just asked him about the horse, and he gave me a lot of details about the horse. And you could just tell that that he was very intimate with the horse. He knew every single thing that was going on with the horse, told us a couple of things that we needed to know as far as personality. And just, it was just great to have that kind of connection with Tommy. And he was very forthright about the horse, you know, and the horse way outsold, I think, even his expectations. You know, they almost got $200,000 for the horse, and he was really worth it. You know, it was the kind of thing where the Bolt Doros are running, which helps. But the colt, this colt in particular, really, really showed himself well. And that's why, you know, when they only bring one horse up to a sale like that, it's because he's the goods. And I know we said that pre-sale, but I can tell you post-sale that that Tommy and Wendy did a phenomenal job with this horse. And the horse sold really, really well.
This week's Remy cartoon gives us a look at the Ye Olde Rules of Racing book. Honestly, I wish we had that. I wish we had that book. That would be an upgrade over what we currently have, but it's got a bunch of post-it notes sticking out of it and a little tube of whiteout with Heisa printed on it that I think whiteout is significant in that Heisa is going to try to come into this Ye Olde book of racing rules and try to fix things without actually overturning everything. And I think that's the goal of Heiser right now. And shout out to Remy because, yeah, that's what I think is going on for sure. It's a little messy, but at least we got some white out on the case for now, at least. All right. So we wanted to do this before we signed off. This is our 150th episode. We made a big deal about 50 and a big deal about 100. Not as making as big. I feel like this is like an old marriage where you make less of a deal about the anniversaries over time. Like you celebrate the 10th one and the 20th one. And over time, it's like, well, let's just get dinner and go to sleep early, maybe pass out on the couch watching TV. But no, it's always nice to reach this milestone. And it's, you know, we're honored and we're flattered that people love the show enough that it's lasted 150 episodes. Like that's a pretty damn good run. We're approaching like MASH levels of episodes here in terms of long running syndication. But, you know, I obviously appreciate you guys. I appreciate Bill and John. And I still love doing the show. You know, I still love getting on here and BSing with you guys and debating and going back and forth because, you know, I respect you guys' opinions so much, but also, you know, all the people behind the scenes that work on the show, like Patty and Katie and Aaliyah and Anthony and Nathan and all the sponsors as well, who have jumped in over time and helped us, you know, really, really grow the show. And it's really hit home for me, honestly, being at Saratoga, because I run into a lot of people, and you know, people will come up to me or DM me and say, like, you know, that they're big listeners and talk about how much they love the show. Bobby Flay, you know, shout out to Bobby. I saw him at dinner on Friday night, and we talked for like 10 minutes. He was talking about how much he loves the show, which is obviously an honor. And you know, I think it really has occupied a place in this industry that did not necessarily exist before, at least in podcast form, where we talk about the issues of the day and we don't sugarcoat anything. And we're honest and clear-eyed about what needs to be done and what needs to be fixed in racing. We're not always right, obviously. Sometimes we get on here and talk out of our ass, and the people in the comments are always very, very quick to tell us when we're doing that. But I think overall, we've had a lot of great guests on the show, and I think it does provide a service to the industry. And like I said, we couldn't do it without Bill and John and everybody behind the scenes. What about you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I want to thank all the guests, because 150 shows, we've had some duplicates. Guys like Mark Cassie have been on more than that, but I probably have, 120 different guests that have come on. And, you know, some of the names, the TDN brand definitely helps us, because we're getting people that probably wouldn't do this if, you know, a guy named John was doing, not John Green, a guy named John Smith was doing it out of his basement or something like that. And I really enjoy the talk with them, and being able to get the insights from people in the industry. And, you know, and I think people, when they come on, not everyone, but they kind of know that it's going to be an honest discussion of the topics in racing. And, you know, I think for that, you know, we've been able to, you know, get people to feel comfortable with talking to us and you know, taking a deep dive into some of the issues. You know, and also, like, it every once in a while, being a reporter, I still like it when we break news in here. And I remember, you know, some things I remember, Aiden Butler, to the best of my knowledge, the first time he ever talked about there being a synthetic surface at Gulfstream was on this show. And we had Travis Tigard on a couple times, but the last time he was on, he kept saying if when it came to USADA and getting involved with HISA. And I give you credit, because I didn't pick up on that. And you had said afterwards, hey, why does he keep saying if? Why isn't this a done deal? And, you know, we foreshadowed what was to come there. But I'm with you guys. I do a lot of different things. I like some more than others, but this is a thing that's easy to like to do. And I appreciate the listeners, too, because, you know, people do listen. They do tune in. And without them, we'd be nowhere.
Well, and for me, the show has done a number of things. Number one, it makes me focus and do my homework every week. Because if I have to, you know, match wits with you guys and go through, you know, races and go through sales and go through, you know, interesting topics, I know I spend a lot of time. You guys obviously spend more time than I do even, but I spend a lot of time kind of going through and making sure that we add an educated view point to this. Because I think, as Joe mentioned before, you know, people who are listeners really enjoy hearing a different viewpoint. And some people have come up to us at sales and at races and have thanked us for being the voice of reason. I don't know if we're the voice of reason necessarily, but I know that this podcast has given me a platform to provide information, you know, from an owner's standpoint. And it's made me a better manager of my horses, and it's made me more conscientious of how to handle horses, you know, when the racing career is over. And it's certainly, you know, made me a better person, primarily because I feel like that I have to, you know, match wits with you guys, which isn't always an easy thing week in and week out. It's also personally, it's increased my exposure, you know, for the industry. And I know there's no way that I would have been elected onto the three boards and the Breeders' Cup if it wasn't for this show. And if it wasn't for you guys pushing me to be a better steward of the industry. And there's been a couple of shows that over the years that really kind of, you know, hit home for me. And I kind of went through some of the 150 shows. And, you know, the first show, guys, it was you two and Alan. And it was 38 minutes back in August of 19, and there was no guest. And that was, you know, you broke through kind of a glass ceiling by having a podcast. And then, you know, the following week, it was 41 minutes long. I was, you know, invited into the show. And as you guys mentioned, I haven't left since. You know, you're going to have to get me kicking and screaming to leave here. Ironically enough, the following week, you know, 9/11 of 19, our listenership actually decreased. And I'm sure it had to do with the fact that I was on the second show, which is why the third show wasn't as well received. But, you know, then we started picking up steam. You know, we learned that we could kind of, you know, pick on each other a little bit and needle each other a little bit. And we didn't always have to agree with each other. And that was okay. So by the time that show 27 came around, when the indictments were handed down by the U.S. Attorney's Office, You know, we could all really get raw and emotional about it. And I think that, to me, that's really when the show turned a corner, was at that show in March of 20, when we were able to discuss, you know, pretty much the way we felt about the indictments and about the way the industry was going, and the fact that, you know, it was a bittersweet day. We, you know, about, it was a negative day with the indictments, but could it be positive down the road? And now, like 2.5 years later, we're starting to see, you know, that things are really going in the right direction. And humbly, I like to think that we have a lot to do with that, that you know, that this show gives us, you know, the opportunity and the voice to talk about some of the difficult problems that are going on with the industry, and more importantly, how to fix them. You know, and those are just some of the shows that I remember. There's one show in particular that episode 31, when we were, you know, when we were in a COVID lockdown and we had to do our first show via Zoom. And Patty, I think you have a picture of this, but look at Joe's hair, for God's sake. I mean, you talk about, you know, retrospective. I mean, Joe is like, he's sporting the COVID fro there. I mean, it really is kind of funny. And then episode 35, we went to a Brady Bunch, you know, type teaser where we're looking around and stuff. And yeah, it was goofy, but it was really, really fun. It was fun to do. And then we did a couple of road shows. You know, we got to go to OBS. We got to go to Saratoga. We all went to Keeneland. You know, and that was really, really fun, too. But at the end of the day, for me, it really comes down to, you know, the listeners, obviously, that give us feedback and tell us when we're doing right and when we're not, when we need to improve our game. And there's certainly times, you know, where that happens. You guys thanked a lot of people. And I really want to end this by thanking, with all sincerity, thanking Patty Wolf and Sue Finley, our leader, because this is their love child. This was their idea of putting, you know, three knuckleheads on display to talk about, you know, our feelings about the industry. And for the most part, they've given us carte blanche to talk the way we want to talk and to express our feelings the way we want to. I think I get, you know, nicked a couple of times as far as going a little bit over the line. And thankfully, you know, Patty and Sue can pull me back into reality so we don't get sued. But I really want to thank Patty and Sue for giving us the opportunity to talk about this industry that we all love. And at the end of the day, we all love horse racing. We all want it to thrive. We all want it to continue. And we look at it from very different viewpoints. And guys, I can't also thank you enough for your friendship and your support over the 3 years, because really, you know, I was a stranger to you guys and vice versa when we started the show. And I feel a real kinship to you guys. And I know we give each other, you know, a lot of shit and hard times sometimes, but I really feel it's all out of love and respect. And I want to thank you guys also for making me a better horseman and a better manager and a better podcaster.
Yeah. And it's all about, to me, this show is all about love and respect and good faith. You know, I have a lot of love and respect for you guys. I have a lot of love and respect for our listeners. And it's about good faith in that. I think the people, one of the reasons, like Bill was saying, that people, so many people do come on the show, is I think that they know that we're operating in good faith from a place of good, where we want to change the industry for the better. That's why we're doing this. That's why we started this. And that, you know, John said we'll take a little credit for it. I will 1000% take credit for the reform, for some of the reforms that have come along in racing, because I don't think that there is a similar voice doing this kind of thing still to this day. So yeah, all about love and respect for y'all and for everybody that listens. And you know, we appreciate every single person who's ever dropped a line, who's ever sent a comment or told us how much they love the show. You know, it really does mean a lot, and it keeps us going, and to know that people are out there listening and really care and are really about what we're trying to do. It means everything to us, and shout out to you guys, because obviously wouldn't be able to happen without Bill and John, and I appreciate your perspectives. And yeah, there we go. Let's throw up the hearts. Bill will never do it. There it is.
Hey, there we go. Woo! It only took 150 shows.
Virtual group hug. We'll leave it at that. But yeah. All right, so that's going to do it for this week's 150th episode of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. Don't forget, the Keeneland September yearling sale begins Monday, September 12th. That catalog is online now. You can learn more at theworldsyearlingsale.com. I want to thank very sincerely Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Tyler Gaffleone, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for all the support through 150 episodes. We'll see you next week.